Любо, братці, любо, братці, жить. З нашим отаманом воно приходиться тужить. І за балки лунко, лунко в береги вдарили одразу короткі батоги. Батько нахилився, коня у кар'єр, висікти сволоту цівку плечем впер.
Welcome to the Hipsid podcast with me, Rabbi Simcha. This is a unique podcast, and I wish that today's guest was being interviewed under very different circumstances, but this is where we're at, and I felt this was an important interview to have and to document. We're interviewing today a very dear friend of mine, of our community. I hope I get your last name right, Nora. Nora Savoznik from Norway. So, Nora, I have a little bit of a bio for you, and then we're going to discuss where you are and what you're currently doing. Nora hails from the holy country of Norway and is an internationally renowned photographer. You won the Lens Culture Emerging Talent Award in 2018. I know that you were at the ICB, the International Center of Photography, because I was there for your thesis, and the work was incredible, which is, for those that don't know, the ICP is one of the world's leading institutions for photography, and you were actually invited as the first recipient of the Reuters Scholarship for Visual Journalism. We have spent many, many Shabbat dinners and holiday meals together, and I hope we will do in the near future, but you are currently working as a reporter in Ukraine. I'd like to ask you, Nora, if you could tell us where you are. Please don't say anything that compromises anyone's security, and who you're working for, and maybe a little bit of life on the ground from your vantage.
So I'm currently in Kiev, the capital. I've been here now for a week, and I've been in Ukraine now for about 2 weeks. For that, I had a gap where I went to Norway, and I was in Ukraine and left on the 17th of February. Yeah, life on the ground. Where to start? Well, I'm able to meet a lot of people, and I first want to start by saying how inviting and incredible the Ukrainian people are. I think that's a very important point to make. One thing that struck me and touched me in the beginning of this journey. Ukraine is a huge country. We've been fortunate enough to be traveling around. And you see on the roads, people put handwritten signs on their cars saying children in Russian, hoping that the Russians will not attack their car while they're fleeing. And just saying it out loud gives me goosebumps, but riding along the highway here, seeing it has made a huge impact. And then to the people and the humans we've been able to meet and make stories around. For example, we, a few days ago, went to the hospital. There was a family who tried to flee. The bomb alarm went off. They run underneath the bridge, but there were shellings, and the son, 5 years old, was hit and is now in the hospital. The whole family is in the hospital. They were laying in each their bed. And at some point, their son, I'm not using their names, but it will be published in the next few days in Aftonbladet, which is my employer here that I'm on assignment for. But yeah, they were laying in each their bed, and you can see this five-year-old getting emotional. And then the mother is trying to get up from the bed, comforting him, but she's also very hurt. She can't really reach him. And moments like that shows how civilians are really hurt in this conflict. And to me, that was a moment that struck me. The conflict has been going on for over a month now. So daily life, they're also trying to get back to something. So here in Kyiv, you can see that slowly and very not many stores are opening up. I went to a stand-up show yesterday, which was absurd. The humor is very dark.
What I wanted to ask you, that as it's almost counter to nature, what you have chosen to do as so many, I believe close to 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled, understandably, and ran away from danger you've chose to run towards danger. And what does that feel like as a photographer? And given the fact that there is an evil tyrant, a tyrant that has made the media and the press enemy, what does that feel like for you as an artist and as a humanitarian and a human?
Right. So I've been asked that many times, because I guess that's what journalists often do. It's quite absurd, but we go against what everyone else does. People leave Kiev. They don't go towards Kiev. I remember the train right here. It was almost an empty train. It was completely dark because you're not supposed to have light on. Wow. Because then it's easier for the Russians to shoot and target. And it was a few men sitting. They all had just a sleeping bag and bottle, like a bottle of water, because they were going there to fight. And those are the people going in the direction of Kiev at the moment. But the thing is, there is power in numbers. And what you said is that Russia is trying to take control over the narrative. And we can never let the perpetrator create the narrative or be in control of the only narrative. So I do think it is important for us to go in that direction and document it. Ukrainians are doing it well on social media, but I think you also need an international presence.
The juxtaposition of the conflict is remarkable. To see a tyrant control the media in an entire country, and then to see in Ukraine a president who is documenting from a cell phone on the ground on Instagram, that the contrast is very shocking and almost a metaphor for these two leaders, if I can call Putin a leader at this point. Mm-hmm. You did spend, I believe, a night in a maternity ward in a basement of a hospital in Kiev. And I saw your photography was remarkable. What was that like? And what was it like to witness birth and life surrounded by death?
Right. It's an extreme contrast. It was my first time in a maternity ward in general. So just seeing life being born was incredibly touching and loving. And then at the same time, you know, it's in a basement and there's a bomb going off outside. They have like small windows, but it was completely covered up. So no light would go in. So yet again, the Russians weren't targeted. As we know, they have targeted maternity wards before in the metropole. There's something very beautiful in hell when you describe a birth in this shelter. The women were incredibly brave. One woman we spoke with had 1 month left of her pregnancy when the war broke out. And her husband said, "We should flee." And she said, "It's too late. I don't want to give birth suddenly while we're fleeing. I can't take that." And the doctors did a C-section on her because her body had been under so much stress for that past month. And you could see that with a lot of women, there was a lot of stress concerning what was going on outside, and they wanted to flee. But it's hard with a newborn baby or when you are pregnant so late. Right. And where to flee to is also, the men are not allowed to leave. Are you going to leave your husband behind?
I mean, this conflict has profoundly, understandably, but as it has many, but profoundly disturbed me in a very primal way. And I'm still grappling with that. And I think what I wanted to ask you was, and what I find just perplexing, is the way that the Jews have been used as a shade, and the fact that the so-called rise of Nazism has been used and fabricated largely as an excuse to go to war. What does that feel like to you, and how do you connect with that?
Well, my grandfather is a Holocaust survivor. He was one of 34 Norwegian Jewish Holocaust survivors. He went to Auschwitz. So I'm very connected to the story of the Nazi regime and how they were obsessed with keeping control over the visual narrative. In Auschwitz, there was only 4 pictures not taken by a SS soldier, which is insane. And Putin is trying to do the same. He's trying to stay completely in control of the visual narrative. There was 2 photographers in Mariupol. They were both on a list of targets that the Russians wanted killed. And you see that throughout Ukraine, Russians are targeting journalists because they're afraid. So you see similarities in those 2 leaders, Hitler and Putin, in that sense, or a lot of extreme regimes are trying to control visual narratives.
We have a very dear mutual friend, Rina, who brought us together and continues to be the glue. Rina had told me, because I called her, I told her we're going to have this conversation. She told me about a photograph that you saw when you were younger of a lady in the Holocaust being, I believe, waterboarded by the Nazis. Yeah. And that you grew up, even though that your grandfather had experienced the Holocaust, your home, it was not spoken about. And that photograph had sort of touched you. And I'm just curious how that connected to your photography.
Right. So I wouldn't say that it wasn't spoken about. It was more me being ashamed of my Jewishness. I grew up in a country where Jew was a common curse word in the schoolyards. And I was the only Jew. It's a very small Jewish population in Norway. It was very few survivors, as I said. And very few of them had children. And so it was more me being ashamed of the story rather than my family not telling me. But I remember finding this book and looking through the images, and it was devastating because I remembered really well, and it's why I'm a photographer today, I would say, because this woman is being tortured. She looks like my mother. She looks like an East European Jewish woman. And there's a doctor writing notes, but is smiling into the camera and he's enjoying it. And it was horrifying feeling that he was smiling at me. This also goes back to the idea of we can't let the perpetrator stay in control of the narrative that's being told.
Right.
That's also the reason why sometimes you have to go against whatever the road everybody else is taking.
So there is, I believe they call it epigenetic inheritance. There's an idea that environmental influences can affect literally one's genetic makeup. There was a study done out of Mount Sinai of 32 Jewish men and women either been in camps or witnessed camps or experienced torture. And they'd found that in children and grandchildren that experienced sort of effects of that to the point where even there's been a gene change in some of those children and grandchildren. We call it today generational trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just seeing these images from Ukraine and photographs such as yours and seeing that locale and that location and that aesthetic and those faces, it was so primal. It was something I didn't ever imagine seeing in my lifetime. And to the point where, and I'll be honest to the listener, that early on in this conflict, we live close to JFK Airport. There was a point where there were so many planes. And I was telling my wife, it's the Russians. I was afraid. There was one day I couldn't get out of bed. I was absolutely paralyzed with fear. And I'm curious if how that generational trauma, if you feel that and how that has been influence and an effect on this experience.
Well, it's a very complex question. Right. And I don't have the answers in my own genetics. I haven't taken any tests, but I am very interested in generational trauma myself.
Your mother's a social worker, you told me.
Yeah, both of my parents are social workers. Oh. And I feel very connected with people who say they are grandchildren or children of Holocaust survivors. And I am working on a personal project about Jewish life in the Western world right now to understand my own Jewish heritage and how it has shaped me. And also going back to my grandfather, which is one of very few Norwegian Holocaust survivors. And what that brought with it, how that connects me to this conflict. I think it comes back to this idea, we can't let the perpetrator take control. We can't. And I feel strongly towards that because of my own family history. There's been this kind of devastations and other conflicts in the world. What's different now for me is it's closer to home. Norway borders to Russia. My family lives in Norway. It's Europe. And I have friends here. But it's horrible. It's like, I horrible is not the word to use. It's to see what Putin is doing is, and also not knowing what his next step is and how he is targeting shelters, maternity wards, really like clearly civilian places. Yeah, as I said, the family I just met, they were clearly civilians. They were trying to flee. They had this sign on their car saying they had children. They had their own kids in the car written in Russian, and they still were hit. So, yeah.
Just as a friend, I'm asking you right now, and as a rabbi and someone that loves you, you have protective equipment when you're doing this?
Right. Yes, absolutely. So safety is a big priority. So I have a bulletproof helmet, a vest, and I'm wearing first aid kit with me everywhere, which includes a tourniquet in case you get shot. And I've also been trained in what to do. But there's always big, logistic problems on assignments like this. Like, how far can you go? And you don't know where and who they're going to target. I think I recently read 7 journalists have been killed so far, and the civilians and numbers are also is huge. So you don't know, but you also always have to every morning figure out what have been the movements, where can we go, where can we not go. We work with the local fixer, we have a local driver. So it's adjustments you have to take all the time. And you're like, for a hotel, you have to know they have a good shelter to stay in. The bombs are falling, and I can hear them all the time. The hotel I'm staying at has turned off the alarm for bombs because it goes off all the time. And sometimes you can feel the bed shake.
On the ground, you speak Russian, Ukrainian, English?
No, so we have a translator who's local from Kiev, who is translating.
You know that I'm also an autism advocate, and it's actually only recently that been an increased understanding around education and inclusion within Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It was only until 2014 that autism was recognized as a disorder within Ukraine. And I can't imagine families who fought so hard to get rights for their children, and knowing that some of the challenges that these individuals can face around anxiety, inability to communicate, I cannot imagine. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. Beyond. Is that something you've seen in the hospital?
I've been to two hospitals so far, and I've been to places that's been bombed. I went to a place that just recently had been bombed, maybe half an hour before I showed up. It's like, I'm not a doctor. I don't know how people have autism or not, but people are crying, screaming on the streets. They just lost their home, torn to pieces. The pictures is laying on the floor of her husband. The people are trying to clean up the remainings. Maybe they find something precious. And they didn't believe it would happen. This was 5 kilometers from the city center of Kiev. But me, I don't know their background, but everyone is hysterical in that moment. I can't imagine sitting in it myself. I would probably scream and cry as well.
So you mentioned, I'm bringing this up because you mentioned it, and I saw it on your Instagram, you experienced a comedy night a night ago. And by the way, it's somewhat of a Jewish tradition of gallows humor. Mel Brooks famously said, the play Springtime for Hitler, that if you have the last laugh, you win, sometimes even when you lose. And what was that like?
As I said in the beginning, it's slowly, the few places are opening up. Everything used to be shut down. And when I arrived a week ago, it was a 36-hour curfew. You weren't allowed to leave your house. And if you did, you were considered an enemy. And therefore, you can expect extreme consequences. So I spoke to this stand-up comedian, and this was her first show since the war started. And it was in a bunker. It was in a bomb shelter. It was before the curfew went in, which is 8 p.m., but it was dark. It was dark humor. It was about death, Putin, dry bread. One joke was that she was preparing in the mirror what kind of post she wanted to have if she died, like if she was shelled, like how would she lay, which is extreme jokes. But as you said, it's also relieving, you know, to give a laugh. This war has been going on for over a month. People have lost loved ones, and they have loved ones in territories now that are extremely dangerous. Yeah, I think it is. It can be healing.
You say oppressed people tend to be witty. And I think it fascinates me that President Zelensky has, as well as being Jewish and being, a grandchild of survivors, but to have a background in entertainment and media. And I don't know what the relationship has been like with the government, the officials themselves, and the press.
So I have not spoken to Zelensky. So I don't know his relationship to the press. I know he's given a lot of interviews, but we have not spoken to Zelensky. We have not spoken to any big officials in Ukraine.
The photographs that you're taking are seen, this is for the Norwegian media or it's for the Danish media?
Swedish, actually. So I freelance and I work for a few different clients. And this is for a newspaper called Aftonbladet.
So you're in Sweden?
But it's the largest one in Scandinavia, so you can get it.
Where were you for Purim? Have you seen the Jewish community?
I was here. For this trip, I haven't seen the Jewish community. My last trip, February, I actually went to a Chabad rabbi and spoke to him in Kiev. I haven't kept contact with him. Last time I spoke to him, we asked if he thought the war would happen and what he would do. He was building up a shelter. He wanted to shelter 250 Jews, and he was already getting mattresses and stocking up food, and was already doing the food delivery to the elderly. Being in a war zone is very chaotic. I think he's still in Kiev. He said he would stay to take care of his community, but I'm not sure what happened to him. That story was for a Norwegian newspaper.
I mean, there's tremendous Jewish history in all of these locations.
Right, there really is, but it's also a very tragic history of the Jewish people from the Second World War as well. So that was kind of the underlying theme of that story. But yeah, Chabad Rabbah, he was building up for 250 people. I don't know. And it's so many more people who's left. And people are still fleeing. So I'm actually leaving now. Well, I'm slowly leaving. It's a whole process. Like, you can't just jump on an airplane and go to New York. We are going to see if we can take out the train. So it's all like safety measures. We're seeing if we can take the train out from Kiev tomorrow during the day. It's a long train ride and we prefer not to do it during the night because most of the shelling and bombs are during the night. Our train ride here was supposed to take 5 hours. It took 8 hours. So we were driving during the night and that became a safety problem. So we'll see. We're trying to get out around 8, 9, but then you can't, all the trains out of Kiev West is evacuation trains. So you can't buy tickets and they prioritize, of course, Ukrainians. So we'll see if we will get on a train tomorrow morning. And then we're heading towards Lviv, staying in Lviv for maybe a night, and then over to Poland. And from Poland, you can fly back to New York, which is our plan for now on.
I have a couple more questions because I know you're busy. You're very brave. Could you just tell everyone how old you are?
I'm 26. But like I said, like
you've always been an old soul, Laura. I know that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I've heard that many times. I'm not sure if I should say thank you, but yeah. But as I said, the Ukrainian people are extremely welcoming and kind. I've not felt threatened in any possible way. I have not encountered any Russian soldiers. And I feel safe with the Ukrainian people. I really do. They take good care of each other. And yeah, they are the ones who's brave. They're the ones who are forced to leave their homes, what they love.
Right. Is there anything you'd like people to know listening to this podcast?
Well, there's many ways of supporting the civilians in Ukraine.
Right.
One thing is speaking about it. People that I am with here are very thankful for us telling their story. They want the world to know what's going on and the barbaric acts of Putin. So one thing you can do as a student is to share people's stories so people get aware and start bringing politics into it. The second thing you can do is donate. And the third thing you can do if you're in Europe or anywhere else is open your home. You know, these people did not expect to be refugees. Their life was turned around and so could ours. Yeah.
You see how fragile life itself is and how quickly. I felt the eeriness before the war from Brooklyn. You could feel, it was that thick that I felt it in my kishkas. Where were you at the moment when things broke?
So the foreign ministry of Norway asked all Norwegians to leave Ukraine and I chose to stay. This was in, I guess, mid-February. And then we stayed on. And then eventually the foreign minister actually called my editor and said, we're not going to help them out in any possible way. You should get them out. And then we decided to leave. And then I was in Florida on assignment in a place called The Villages, which is a place for old people. In the U.S. is like a retirement community. It's the fastest growing city in America. So it was super absurd. I was on this.
Talk about a juxtaposition. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You've gone from bowling in Florida to, okay, I can't imagine.
Yeah, and then I got the news and I was horrified because I just left it a few days ago. I texted my editors and said, I want to go back. And then they said it was too dangerous. It was too dangerous. And I would have just gone. But the problem is there's a lot of measurements you have to do, like insurance. Like nobody wants to give you an insurance for a war zone. And it's dumb to just go without it. But then eventually now my editor said, okay. And then that means that I also now have an insurance.
As your rabbi and your friend, I'm proud and I'm freaking out at the same time. How is your mother?
Oof. The whole other story is right. That I feel bad for her. I think for me, like, this is not about me. I'm not here for me, even though I'm not talking about myself. But to make like a personal note, I think the most difficult thing about going to places like this, and I do this for a living as work, is the family at home. Like, my mom has a hard time sleeping. My sister is having her final exam in med school in May, and she's nervous and she has a hard time reading. So you always have to weigh up, is it worth it? Do I really believe that what I do is worth the pain of my loved ones? But I really do believe that what I do is important. So I'm not personally scared because I believe in what I do, but I think the fear is really within my parents and my sister.
Your photographs, and I do impel anyone listening to this to check out how can we find your, what is your Insta handle and your photographs?
Right.
There's a photograph for your thesis. You did a lot of work with the Hasidic community, and there's a photograph of you and your mother that is so like raw. I believe it was an award-winning piece of photography, but you capture the human essence and the human soul and consciousness such a profound, real way. I know that what you're doing there is going to have an impact throughout the world and throughout the ages. So I think light will shine over darkness. And I think that this clearly transcends all of us. And I think what you're doing has tremendous worth. And I think your family are very proud, as is your rabbi.
Thank you. I'm not the one who takes pictures of the destroyed houses. I want to meet the people and understand the empathy, the love, the connection is more the route I take, even though it's a lot of things destroyed around me.
How do you sleep? Personally, I'm asking you as a friend right now.
Right. In the beginning, it was like you get used to it, which is strange. In the beginning, I was running down to the bomb shelter several times a night, and I slept in the bomb shelter in the bomb shelter now.
Really?
But you get used to it.
I was going to ask you where you were, but I'm scared to ask.
No, it's reasons, not a problem, safety-wise. Unless some of your listeners are in Kiev and they want to target me. It's a joke. No,
That's a purpose-built shelter that you're in, because it looks like a...
No, so that's
the
thing.
It looks glamorous, if I can use that.
Yeah, it is. It's a conference room in a nice hotel, but it's on the first floor and there's no windows. You should stay away from the windows. You should be as low as possible. And then you can see there's lots of beds around me. But this is a very fancy bomb shelter. I've been to much worse than this. But yeah, no, you get used to it. And that's what the people of Ukraine are starting to grapple with. That's why they open small things. Because you have to have a life. And I think that's the absurdity of war. You kind of have to learn how to live with it in some way.
Right. And I think that your work does show that latent spark of humanity in everyone. And I hope it reaches far and wide. And just to sort of end off, I'll put on my yarmulke for a second. It was on the whole time. I'll put it on double. The next Jewish holiday is Passover. It's the season of freedom. And we know that freedom only comes when one is released from slavery to ego. And I hope that this dictator, that the ego is somehow nullified and that there can be some semblance of freedom over Passover. And I guess my final question is, how is your faith and your Jewishness, I guess, infused and informed these moments for you?
I'm working on this project for several years trying to figure out what it means to be Jewish. And I haven't really figured that out. I think it more has to do with the history, as you said, with the trauma that my family has been through because they're Jewish, more than the actual faith in God. Yeah.
And there's a complicated Jewish history, as you alluded to, in this region. Yeah. Is that something you think about?
No. First and foremost, I'm thinking about the war that's happening in front of my window. Yeah.
Just the brutality. Like I said before, it is overwhelming. It is absolutely overwhelming. And to see it so rigorous and primal and just non-stop, it is absolutely overwhelming. And we want to wish you safety, security. We want to wish peace and love to the region and know that from my little room in Brooklyn, we stand with you, with the people of Ukraine, and really with anybody who's being oppressed. This is truly, truly, truly horrific. And I know that your best friend, Rina, is praying for you every day. She calls me every day. She has a love and a pride, and you both have a bond. And I hope we'll get to celebrate one of those Shabbat dinners very soon in the near future. So we want to wish you God bless to you and to all of the press, to all the people, to all of the civilians that have become soldiers. And that's... Something remarkable is the bravery. You read these stories. The Times had an amazing, in the magazine this past weekend, they were profiling ordinary civilians that have now become soldiers and what they were doing 6 weeks ago from what they're doing now, and to see like such courage, such bravery. I'm sure that you're surrounded by it. So is there anything finally you'd like to say on the podcast? How can we see your work again?
I try to post on Instagram. So that would be Nora Savosnik. Nora.Savosnik. Nora.Savosnik would be where you can find me.
Or if we buy the Swedish daily newspaper, is it Swedish?
Yeah.
By the way,
it's Swedish.
My producer did send me a comment. He said apparently that is a very, very famous newspaper.
Well, it's the biggest one in Scandinavia.
Right. So you have to accept my apologies.
No. How would you know? It was my grandfather's favorite newspaper. I remember my first meeting with the photo editor and I said it was my grandfather's favorite newspaper. Wow. So I'm very happy to work with him.
And your grandfather.
And I wish he was alive to see it.
Right. I'm sure he's getting tremendous nachas, as they say in the Yiddish vernacular, watching his granddaughter document these things so that what happened in his generation shouldn't be happening ever again. And I think that's what you're doing. So we thank you and we love you and we stand with you and we're here for you. And you have a courage, you have a bravery, you are an old soul. And is there any humanitarian efforts on the ground that you've seen? Because if we want to send money, it's hard to know who to send and where to send. Is there anything
I've seen a lot? And actually, we were drawing for Venezia. We'd just been into Shitmir, and then two women were joining us. And it turned out that Yad Vashem was planning their escape because their grandmother helped Jews during the war, and now Yad Vashem was helping them back. So there's a lot of organizations, and I've seen a lot of it.
So what's the future once you leave for you?
First, we need to figure out a plan to leave, which is going to take a couple of days. That's like my goal for the future.
As you leave Ukraine will never leave you. So when I think...
No, I hope to come back. I hope to come back very soon. I unfortunately think this war is going to go on for a really long time.
Well, stay safe. Stay connected.
Thank you.
We're here for you. And I just wish you safety and peace. God bless. And thank you for doing this. I want the world to know what you're doing and to know how proud your rabbi is of
you,
26 years old, when the world, quite rightly, as people are escaping for their lives, that you choose to preserve and protect the liberties and freedoms of the lives of others. So it says a lot about you. I'm proud of you. And thank you for doing this, Nora.
Thank
God bless.
Thank you.
Talk soon. Be well.
З нашим отаманом не приходиться тужить. А третя куля цілила в мене, мого коня мене. Як терпець урвався, то не налякать, тільки дотягну.